I met Shahar and Netta, his lovely wife, in about 2005. And I came across this book here, Charles Olson and Alfred North Whitehead, when I was working on my film about Charles Olson. And, you know, about a little time, maybe a year after that, I don't know, we were emailing, and then all of a sudden, Shahar and Netta were around here on the East Coast, and I got a phone call, and we met, and they came up to Gloucester. Now, after writing this book about Olson, it was the first time that Shahar was in Gloucester. So it was a great meeting, and we talked about Charles Olson. And there's a little small snippet in the film with Shahar where he talks about coming here for the first time, and it's a wonderful, heartfelt and exciting little piece, because you can tell by his tone of voice that he's really happy to be in this place that he had been reading about for years and years and years. And since then, he came back to Cape Ann and for a sabbatical, spent a year here. And for the last 10 years, the two and their family have been coming back and forth to Gloucester. So we're happy to have him here. As far as his professional background, Shahar studied philosophy and comparative literature at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. In his MA thesis and his PhD dissertation, he examined the influence of American poets such as Olson, Robert Lowell, and John Berryman on major Hebrew poets. His own poetry includes City of Love, which is in Hebrew, from 1999. And a few years back, he and Netta collaborated on a book called Colorful Was Their Voice, which pays tribute to American poetry in word and image. And his fiction includes The Stones from Two Cities Press in 2012. And it's a very dark tale about a young man searching for his vanished girlfriend. It's very cinematic. I enjoyed reading it a lot. His scholarly works include The Ambassadors of Death, Sister Art's Western Canon, and The Silent Lines of a Hebrew Survivor. And that is on the work of Tuvia Rubner, who he'll be talking about tonight, is in that book. And he's also, it's not out yet, but there's a translation of Rubner's verse that will soon be released in the United States. So with that, I'm going to bring this back up and Shahar, take it over.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
All right, and thank you for coming. And this is the book. Okay. Unfortunately, I thought it would be ready, but it's coming out next month. Zephyr Press. It's a co-translation by Lisa Katz and myself. Of Tuvia Rubner's poems, which is Tuvia Rubner is I think is the most celebrated poet nowadays in Israel. He's 91. He still writes. Great poet. And as Henry mentioned, I already dedicated a book which dealt with the relationship between poetry and works of art and the ekphrastic poems of Tuvia Rubner, that is poems about works of art. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Tuvia Ribner tonight and present some of the poems that are in this book coming out soon. Tuvia Ribner, Israeli Prize Laureate in Poetry in 2008, Emeritus Professor of Hebrew and Comparative Literature at Haifa University, and an accomplished photographer since his teenage years, was born in Bratislava, Slovakia, in 1924, with German as his mother tongue, in addition to other local languages. He arrived in Mandatory Palestine in 1941, never again to see his family or his home. Home. That's the first poem. Home. 57 Grassling Street is up for sale. It was a moment of quiet. It was a nest filled with dreams. The lock on the door too high for a child's hand. The back garden too gray for two roses. The walls too easily crossed by the murderer's legs. And nonetheless, it was a home for a few years, an alphabet for a sister, a shell for the lament of youth, mother's faith, evening light, window of fear, parents do not return, the sister is nowhere. Go forth from your native land and from your father's home, a baseless dream. Upon arrival in his new homeland at the age of 17 by himself, Ribner was sent to Kibbutz Merchavia, where he lives to this day in a typical, very modest kibbutz house. As in the life of other immigrants and refugees, terms like home, motherland, and mother tongue would remain problematic and central to his work. Ribner continued to write in German long after his arrival to pre-Israel, and would always remain a sort of a European intellectual, a learned poet whose poems correspond with European literature, art, and history. Unlike fellow immigrant poets like Yehuda Amichai, which I guess you know, and Nathan Zach, another very famous Israeli poet, for whom German was a mother tongue as well, Ribner didn't adapt to the ways of the emerging Israeli poetry of the time, and as a poet was not formed by English-American tradition. Far from the literary circles in Tel Aviv, apart from the new Israeli cultural trends, Ribner felt close to poets like Leah Goldberg, with whom he indeed became close friends, and who was responsible for the publication of his first Hebrew poem in 1950. That's his first Hebrew poem. I am not the one I was. I am not the one I am. I am neither here nor there. I live between water and air. Bit by bit, I live in fire. My eyes burnt, my arms burnt, my lips burnt. Burnt are these words. He who whispered these words lives in an open coffin, watching a framed sky passes by. אינני זה שהייתי, אינני זה שהנני, אינני לא כאן ולא שם, חי בין אוויר ובין מים, לאיתי חי באש, עיניי שרופות, ידיי שרופות, שפתיי שרופות, שרופות מילים אלה, זה שלחשן חי בארון מת, מכסה הוא פתוח, רואה שמיים מרובעים עוברים. In Yiddish, no. As if not already haunted by the death of the family he left behind, Rubner's first Hebrew poem attests to the sad truth that death and loss will continue to be at the heart of his life and work. The lines depict the poet in a hospital bed from which, like from a coffin, himself barely alive, he faces the recent death of his young wife, killed in a car accident in which he was critically burnt. Alone with a baby daughter, a stranger in a strange land, hanging between life and death, between the present and the past, Ribner starts to write poems in Hebrew. Indeed, it took many years and more than 15 volumes of poetry, 2 photography albums and other literary criticism and translations until he was recognized as one of the most original among contemporary modern Hebrew poets. His later poems successfully unite his personal life with the history of European civilization as well as with the political and social concerns of Israeli life, as can be seen in his postcard poems, some of which I will introduce in the following. Postcard from Zurich, that's the first poem from a series of poems which Ribner titled Postcard Poems. Postcard from Zurich, the first in a section devoted to similar titled poems from cities in Europe and elsewhere, provides a clear example of the way Ribner's depiction undermines a superficial postcard-like portrait of a European city that prefers to hide the past. Zurich rubs against the Zurichberg. Zurich doesn't like being tickled under its fur. Zurich likes order, it's hardworking, not necessarily welcoming or particularly warm-hearted, but direct, fair, more or less so. And who doesn't think about profit? Not everything that glitters is gold. Zurich doesn't glitter, it's sober, doesn't like to guess, to solve riddles. Zurich likes facts, the Bonhofstrasse, the Fuhrmünster, zum Strocken, guessed even more, not always poets. The Hauser Büchner died, and Lenin lived. The Kunsthaus, in der I-37, the Utliberg. If an old man calls things by their names, that's enough. One word, an entire life. And it is not easy to insist upon order in this orderly city, which is already a memory that truly emerges suddenly, hides, leaps, hard to restrain in memory. How to restrain? In memory, death is struck dumb. He doesn't have the right to speak, but Zurich has also changed. We have changed more. Zurich is just Zurich in the end. It isn't exhausted. It doesn't look back with a sort of uncertainty. The lake doesn't abandon the city even when it's all wings on a sunny day. I almost forgot. In Zurich, we were all still here together. We sat around one table for our evening meal, each one, all of us. The first lines in the poem make assertions about the nature of the city. What lies behind the calm and sober portrait with which the city presents itself is revealed in line 7. Following the city's apparent preference for facts, fairness and directness, the qualities marking the city's image, the poet lists the Bahnhofstrasse, the Fuhrmünster, zum Storken, the celebrated tourist attractions of the Bahnhofstrasse, that's the station street, the main downtown promenade, and the magnificent church, that's the Fraumünster, the magnificent church nearby, are followed by words that clearly undermine any naive and one-dimensional signifying act like the one an image on a tourist postcard aspires to force on its readers. Ever since the meeting between Paul Celan and Nelly Sachs that took place there on the last days of May 1960, Zum Strocken is more than the Stork Hotel, which stands nearby the other attractions mentioned above. These words refer to the title of the poem Celan dedicated to Sachs. The name of the poem is Zurich zum Strocken. And to the conversation the two had when they met there, a conversation Celan evokes in his poem. Indeed, Celan also evokes in his poem Zurich's great church, the Frauenminister, which the two saw together. Thus, while apparently keeping up with the signifying codes of a touristic postcard, Ribner actually traces the footsteps of the two survivor poets, Celan and Sachs, in the city. He raises the question of European Jewish history buried in the city's sites and subverts a superficial collective memory. Ribner is using the city spread out before him, the image preserved on a tourist postcard, yet while sending the reader to look at it, he is both undermining and broadening the image with the help of what the camera eye cannot see, but the memory of an old man can. Moving on to The House Where Büchner Died, on the same line, maintains this process not only due to the connection of the playwright to Zurich, but because it also strengthens the presence of Celan in the poem. The combined allusion to Celan and Büchner brings to mind Celan's Büchner Prize speech on October 1960, which is titled The Meridian. This speech touches on issues closely related to Ribner's world. To tell his audience what springs a poem free, Celan recalls Büchner's 1836 novella, Lenz. That's the name of the novella. The novella starts, I quote, "On the 20th of January, Lenz walked through the mountains," end of quote. Indeed, it was at the Venessa conference on 20th January 1942, over breakfast, that Heydrich Eichmann and others settled on the final solution. Celan sets an agenda which Ribner's poem echoes. Poetry ought to speak in view of Europe's murdered Jews. Thus, on top of the street and site network, a new network is laid, a set of connections which the poetic language constructs, and a new space is created in the reader's mind, echoing the poet's memory. Ribner uses the postcard to reform the collective memory. The name rises above the muteness of the image and joins the poetic linguistic system in which it functions. That is why, I quote, "If an old man calls things by their names, that's enough. One word, an entire life," end of quote. The new portrait of the city sways between different times. The suspension of the flow of time characteristic of an image is healed by the network that language opens up. In the new space the poem creates, the life of people and the human history come alive. The postcard poem provides the reader with what is present, nonverbal and concrete, along with what is missing, verbal and general. They comprise one and the same reality. Postcard from Zurich, opening with a description of the city, then leads us to deal with the question of memory and the relationship between past and present time, and ends with a seemingly offhand comment, I quote, "I almost forgot, in Zurich we were all still here, together. We sat around one table for our evening meal, each one, all of us," end of quote. In his autobiography, Chaim Arukim Ktsarim, A Long Short Life, the poet offers readers a more direct glance at the tragic events recalled in his poems: the death of his sister, parents, and extended family in the Holocaust, the death of his first wife in a car accident in which he was severely injured, and, after a second marriage which brings forth beautiful love poems to which I will return, the tragic disappearance of a son in South America. Ribner's autobiography describes and locates these events for us. We know that Ribner's family, with the son, spent 1963 to 1966 in Zurich. The family was still intact. But the poem ends, as many other postcard poems do, with an ambiguous statement, a lack of concreteness that broadens interpretive possibilities. In these poems, death unites the generations, the dead circulating among them. In Ribner's European postcard poems, such as those offering portraits of Zurich, Budapest, or Vienna, the historical framework encloses the world of his childhood, the family lost in the Holocaust, and the later loss of his son. The dead circulate because memory is a living thing and does not obey time's standard divisions. In memory there is no past tense, Ribner writes elsewhere in yet another postcard poem. Postcard from Zurich is an example of such postcard poems from Europe that work by focusing our attention on the details of a geographical and intellectual homeland. The many personal and other details reveal the poet's intimate connection to it. But the postcard poems from Jerusalem, New York, and Rome are different. They are short epigrams of two and three lines. the brevity of the postcard poems from Jerusalem is clearly ironic. Postcard from Jerusalem. Jerusalem left Jerusalem and ran away. That thing up there, surely it can't be Jerusalem. The poet sums up a place that can't possibly be the navel of the world according to Jewish and Christian tradition, the connection between heaven and earth. According to one midrash, Rabbi Yochanan famously said, I quote, "The Holy One, blessed be He, declared, 'I shall not enter the heavenly Jerusalem until I can enter the earthly Jerusalem.'" End of quote. As the earthly city is no more Jerusalem, there is nothing to discuss. The poet makes a quick retreat from Jerusalem, and the poem does the same. The poem turns from epigram to an epitaph on the grave of the city, which is no longer of this world and definitely cannot lead to a heavenly one. New York receives the same ironic treatment in Postcard from New York, and is written in the original in Hebrew, is written partly in English. The last line is English in the original. Rush hour on Fifth Avenue. Lunch hour on Wall Street. The readiness is all. Bye. The poet adopts a major characteristic of the city, cuts the poem off, and hurries on his way. This place doesn't allow attention to be paid. It is all running and noise. It is shapeless. In Postcard from Tel Aviv, which I will not read in full here, the poet says, I quote, "Tel Aviv is almost New York," end of quote. We were talking about it, right? It's Tel Aviv is wannabe New York. The combination of dirt, noise, and a lack of compassion results in total alienation. I quote from the Postcard from Tel Aviv. "People here don't belong to anyone, not even to themselves," end of quote. The poet clearly feels that he doesn't belong in these cities. But between the postcard from Jerusalem and that of New York is postcard from Rome. It too is short, but for completely different reasons. Here the beauty and originality of the city, its strong image, paralyzes those who write about it. Postcard from Rome. Rome speaks in bells, fountains, steps, and, if they are muted, only the wound of words remains. Rome is not silent. The opposite is the case. Its voice mutes the poet. He might be silent, but his memory is at work, overwhelmed by Rome's beauty, always alive in him. The attempt to create a portrait in words fails, paradoxically, because of the poet's strong relationship with the city. The city's language endures the poet. The beauty of its dialects and sounds silences him. The city lives in his memory like a photo come to life that cannot be transmitted to anyone else. Roland Barthes' concept of the punctum is useful here. The punctum, according to Barthes, is that element of the photograph that shocks the viewer, bruises her, and that cannot be transferred to another viewer because it is completely personal. It leaves the injured viewer outside society's boundaries and outside the linguistic order. Huebner, in a way, broadens the punctum, revealing the vitality of emotional visual memories, the force of beauty, which may shock the observer and isolate him in mute individualism. Postcard from Rome is one example of the active nature of a city and the powerful influence of beauty on the poet. These effects are expressed in other poems in other ways that are equally stunning, sometimes because of their uniqueness or because personal or general historical consciousness is added to their beauty, which arouses a self-awareness so strong that it is unattainable or undermines itself. Postcard from Lake Popad in Slovakia is another poem dedicated to a particular place. As with the others, the title locates the reader in a specific site, while the poem itself dives into an inner world. The location is physical and metaphysical at the same time, outside and inside. Postcard from Lake Popad. "The clear eye surrounded by mountains, sky asleep in its net, six heat, looks inward, in, to, itself, look within itself, deep down under the dead, lost in the sight of the memory of life. Popal Lake, surrounded by mountains, is a metaphysical place where a person may dive both into a location and into herself. One is reminded of circles by Ralph Waldo Emerson. I quote, "The eye is the first circle. The horizon which it forms is the second, and throughout nature this primary picture is repeated without end. It is the highest emblem in the cipher of the world." End of quote. Rubner here makes use of the appearance of the eye-shaped lake and the fact that in Hebrew the word for eye, ayin, is also used for a spring of water, in order to combine surface and depth, closed borders and infinity. Rubner is obviously different from the romantic Emerson, though it seems that Emerson's words are relevant here. Emerson sees the eternal circles around us as, I quote, effect, as far as it symbolizes the moral fact of the unattainable, end of quote. Rubner's metaphysical eye cages the entire universe, incorporating the living and the dead, and at the same time remains trapped within its own reflection. Clear sight is also trapped. Consciousness unites with infinity, but only within its borders. Sight returns to itself without nullifying sublime beauty. This is the moment when consciousness seeks to plumb its depth, a moment of infinite awareness of existence whose beauty is blinding. It is loss and reflection. Lake Popod takes the place of Jerusalem as the point connecting heaven and earth, the metaphysical and the physical, being at the same time a metaphor for our living memory, which knows itself and the world at once. Rubner had a very long career, and those postcard poems which I read are from his later books of poetry, but the one book which really marks the turning point in Tuvia Rubner's poetic career is a book called Pesel u'Masecha, Literary Effigy and Mask, published in 1983. The name of the book refers to and rebels against the divine call, the biblical ban on graven and molten images, thou shall not do. The poet dedicates a whole book to poems about works of art by famous Western artists such as Bruegel, Holbein, Munch, or Rembrandt. The book addresses the Jewish experience in a century when God hid his face. The beautiful sculptures and pictures mask death. They cover the hollowness and the void. The book is thus like a museum in which the poet, as the curator, assembles symbolic landmarks of the Western canon. Such a book that undermines the concept of time as a flowing creative force that nourishes life and suggests a narrative. Poems are revealed to be objects, like paintings and statues in a museum. Rubner challenges the Judeo-Christian narrative of redemption and expresses his pessimistic vision of the Western culture. The book opens with the poem The Fall. So I'll read just this opening poem of Pesel u'Masecha.
Kill the words first and we can look at the images after.
Yeah. Or other way around.
Yeah.
That's
The book opens with this poem, The Fall, which refers to two well-known paintings, both of them entitled The Fall of Icarus. So that's The Fall of Icarus. It should be the other way around, but that doesn't matter.
Yeah, the first one is Chagall.
Yes, this one should be here and there. Yeah.
So
Chagall's work is from 1975, and that's Bruegel's, it's the 16th century. The Fall of Icarus. Okay. The paintings, both are titled The Fall of Icarus, but the poem is titled only The Fall.
Okay.
So
actually, about the Bruegel, everybody's going about their life and they don't see him.
And but Ribner makes the question of who's Icarus anyway, you know. The fall. For Chagall, he falls from the heavens, his wings dark flames crossing uselessly behind his back. He is like a fetus detached from the womb. How quickly everything passes, turns into air in startled flight. These midgets, the whole village, gather to watch the scene. Fear leaves an empty space in the middle. Outstretched arms, women crouching to give birth, others dying of laughter, already immense like a cloud, clothing in audience on his life, that still for an instant, there above, strange luck, strays in the labyrinth of his fall. It's not like this with Bruegel. Here only a tiny leg sticks out, while the other is rinsed by small waves. A fisherman is busy with his rod. A boat with large sails goes out to sea. A shepherd, his back to the water, looks at a tree as though it were a miracle. A peasant continues to plow because there is no ignoring the earth's pain and daily toil. Icarus? Who? The sun is already coming down. Darkness is near. I should only mention, I mean, I'm not going to talk about this poem, but there's so much to say about it. But of course, the myth of Icarus, the story, is also a story about a father who loses a son. So it's, once again, Ribner refers to his own loss. With the years passing by, in a very long career, Ribner's poems became more and more open. His early poetry was more dense, and they grew more closely tied to the question of memory, and love poems became an essential part of his oeuvre. So I want to read two love poems dedicated to his second wife, Galila, his soulmate for more than 60 years. Postcard to my soulmate. You won't believe this, a postcard from Paris, Paris de Rêve. The Paris of dreams. What? You say it's London? And the cat on the windowsill, staring forever like an ancient Egyptian, is not Parisian? This can't be. There are no such cats in London, and no such pairs of lovers lying on the grass. What an embrace! Hyde Park, you say? And the fire-eater? It seems like the heart is burning. In London? And the one blowing soap bubbles, like shiny little lies in the sunlight? Where did he come from? And the river, so grey that the passerby on the other side seems not to exist at all? And those people sleeping on the edge of the dock, who knows if they sail off soon, where to? Are they Londoners or Parisians, huh? The Thames, not the Seine? And anyway, how can it be that you answer while I'm writing a postcard and say just the opposite? You mean to say I'm not there at all? That we two are here, next to each other, still close, weaving a dream? Still close together, still a pair of lovers weaving a dream, the poet and his soulmate share the passage of time to which photographs testify, as well as the bodies of the lovers. Is that? I lost it. I lost the poem. Wait. Okay. I didn't expect it to be this way, that we would come to this, that without noticing, night would fall and fill with white sadness. We've grown old, and yet we haven't calmed down. Woe to me and woe to you for this, that we've come to this point, spring in the middle of winter. It hurts. I miss the body that could spread its wings without second thoughts, without doubts that take off. Once again, the petty laments fly around. This isn't what we meant. We wanted to fly, even if low, the height of the grass, but to fly, the flight of the dying. For nothing will change, and we've reached where we are, for we haven't got where to. For we're here such as we are, breathing heavily, lying side by side, face down, for the stars are far away. Ribner is 91, he still writes. His next book is just coming out. Yeah, he keeps saying that that's the last one. And
he
but
also he calls them by names, that are the last poems.
Yeah, he always has, yeah, like, I think it was like 3 years ago which when he published his book, and he it was titled Last Poems, and then he had a real problem with the next one. Yeah. No, she's still alive. She's alive. Yeah, yeah. She's younger. She's 7 or 8 years. Yeah, she's a pianist, a famous pianist in Israel. Ribner is now 91, still writing, and let me conclude with another love poem whose title is "An 88-year-old saying to an 80-year-old as they wake up." Before I saw you, I dreamed none of you. Arriving, you didn't take my breath away. And now, while you lay beside me, I'm home. And without you, I'm none. Thank you.
They are both very good friends of ours, and we meet them. We try to meet them as much as we can, as often as we can.
What a testament to the human spirit, my goodness.
He is amazing.
Having been through what he's been through.
Amazing.
Are you going to read some of your poems? Or do
you
didn't plan to. We can do some.
Shahar, how did you meet
Well, I met Tuvia after I wrote The Ambassador of Death, after I wrote the book which I dedicated to his work, and I sent him the book, and that's I didn't know him before, and he got the book and he made contact, and since then we became quite close.
He said it was a brilliant work. I will tell you. Don't tell the poet that I told you that.
When did you read him in print? When did you first read him?
Just by chance, you know. Just, you know, I keep saying, how did you get to know Olson? I was just, you know, picking the books from the shelf, and suddenly it was in my hand, and I started reading. And Ribner, he wasn't, I mean, as I mentioned, he wasn't a part of the literary circles, never. And he still lives in the kibbutz, far from, you know, from Tel Aviv, which is, you know, that's where everything happens. And I think I was like the first one, I was lucky in this regard, I was like the first one who really dedicated a whole book, a real piece of work to his poems. And it's funny because after my book came out, a few years later, he got the Israeli Prize and all the prizes you can just think of. He became such a celebrated poet. So I was lucky enough, you know, just at the right time.
Does he put his photography with his poems sometimes in his writing? Because he said he was a
Yes. Actually, he has a book which combines photographs and poems.
You don't have that with you?
No, I don't have it here, but the photograph